You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
William G. Siebold was a naturalized American citizen of German descent who was forcefully recruited by the Nazis to spy on the U.S. Instead, he chose to work for the FBI, and he's responsible for the arrest and conviction of 33 spies. Still the largest successfully prosecuted spy case in American history. Peter Duffy tells his story in a new book called Double Agent. It's published by Scribner. I'm very pleased it brings Peter Duffy to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Is it true that at the time there wasn't even a name for what he did?
Absolutely. The phrase double agent, you don't even see it in FBI files until at least the war, and or at least towards the end of the war, really. So they called him a counter spy, is how they explained it to him.
And that was the phrase that was applied to all of the people, the double agents that go way back into history, to Mata Hari.
You know, there may have been a German or French phrase that is an equivalent, but certainly in the American FBI files that I saw, they did not use that phrase.
It is interesting that along with Siebold, there were a number of others during World War II who were kind of offered themselves as double agents. There's the case of John Pujol Garcia, the British spy, who went under the code name Garbo. When he offered himself, the British didn't really believe him.
Absolutely. I think it's a real problem for many of these. Siebold had the same problem. The FBI was really wondered, assumed he was perhaps a triple agent. And took a while. He actually was very upset with them that they didn't believe he was honest and ready to work on behalf of the country.
When did the Germans start planting and recruiting spies in the United States?
Boy, it goes all the way back to when Hitler came into power, and because there was such a German population. According to the 1930 census, there was 350,000 German-born and Austrian-born New Yorkers. There was a real pro-Hitler sense among many of them, and they offered themselves initially to work for the regime.
And that was the German division of the armed forces known as the Abwehr?
Yeah, many of them hooked up with the Abwehr eventually, but a lot of them were just ad hoc men who would write letters offering information, doing whatever they could to help the fatherland.
Weren't German spies in the U.S. a violation of the Treaty of Versailles?
Oh, absolutely. And when it became discovered in 1938 that there were actually active German spies in the United States, was quite a diplomatic problem.
Now, that's 1938, which is years after Hitler came to power. Yes, so they'd been working undetected for quite a few years?
Absolutely. And I tell the story of Hermann Lang, who was working for the Norden Company at 80 Lafayette Street down here in lower Manhattan, who succeeded in stealing the plans for the Norden bomb site, which was our greatest pre-war secret, at a time when the FBI wasn't even looking for foreign espionage agents.
Had the Norden bomb site been commissioned by the U.S. government?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really seen as it would be how our future wars would be fought, that our high-flying planes would drop bombs with unprecedented accuracy, and that's how we would win our future wars.
Because before then it was mostly guess, we probably should drop them now because we're about a half a mile away.
Absolutely. There was really no precision bomb sighting capability, certainly during World War I. And during the 20s, it was only the Norden, created by Carl Lucas Norden. That was a precision bomb sight before the war. No other one existed in the world.
Was there any security at the factory?
Not until not really. I mean, there was some nominal security in the 30s, but not until the war started did they really get serious about it.
Norden himself wasn't a German, but didn't he believe in the superiority of Northern Europeans?
Yeah, he was very much the entire company was a very German company. Many German immigrant craftsmen or draftsmen worked there, living in neighborhoods like Yorkville and Ridgewood.
With no thought of vetting for loyalty?
Not at all. I mean, and remember in the 30s, the mid-30s, up to the late 30s, there was really no sense that we would ever get in a war again. It was a very isolationist country. And, it took Pearl Harbor before we really...
Well, why were we developing a good bomb site if we didn't think we were going to war.
That's we told Congress, so the Navy, it was originally developed by the Army, but the Navy took it over as a coastal defense weapon, was what Congress was told. So it was very much cast as a defensive weapon, as many of them are.
You mentioned Herman Lang, who worked for Norden. He was not really a professional spy. He just offered his services to Germany?
Absolutely. He was an ideological Nazi. He was involved in a Nazi front here in New York.
Was that known to the Norden people?
They may have. He was open about it. He would attend meetings publicly. It was something called the German-American Vocational League, which was full of many laborers working in companies like Norden.
How did he get the bombsite plans?
The story that is told by his spy master, Nicholas Ritter, is that he would bring the plans home from work in the evening, copy them in his kitchen, and return them before the next morning to work before anyone noticed.
And then deliver them to Ritter?
And eventually, yes.
Did Ritter have offices here in New York?
Well, he had a visit in late 1937, Nicholas Ritter, who had lived in the United States previously, so he was fluent in English. And he met with Lang during that 1937 trip and arranged for these plans to be brought to Germany.
What was the initial reaction to the blueprints from the Luftwaffe's technical office?
You know, I think like many spies or spy stories, they could not believe that this was worth anything. They assumed that he was a con artist and just out to get a little money. And Ritter had to insist. Nonetheless, it took many years before they even took this knowledge and developed their own version of the Norden bombsight.
He went to Germany to promote the value of the plans.
Yes, absolutely. They brought him out. He sat down with their technicians, explained how it worked, and only at that point did they realize its worth.
But this is pretty late in the war.
Well, at this point, he visited in the in 1938, in the spring of June of 1938, at a time when they were rapidly preparing to go to war. It's one reason why these were set aside, because they had decided that it would be dive bombers that, rather than the high-flying precision bombing, that would win the wars they were planning on at that point.
Weren't the Germans also concerned that if we captured one of their planes and found the bomb site, that we would figure out what had gone on?
Absolutely. That was a concern as well. And there was a whole – because it was a regime that was full of fear and terror, and it was not as technologically together as perhaps a more functional regime would be. So they weren't quite sure what they had and how to incorporate it.
And this despite the fact that technologically in many ways they were far advanced for going to war. They had the rockets. They had the best tanks. They had, for a while, they had the best airplanes.
Sure, but their Luftwaffe technical office was an absolute mess, and many complaints of very smart aircraft designers like Ernst Haeckel, who couldn't get really smart plans put into place.
My guess is Peter Duffy, whose latest book is Double Agent, The First Hero of World War II and How the FBI Outwitted and Destroyed a Nazi Spy Ring. Is it about this time that the FBI discovered another German spy ring in New York?
Yeah, they very much stumbled upon a low-level agent working here in New York, which became a huge story in 1939, which resulted in a film called Confessions of a Nazi Spy, and there was a real concern among the public that we weren't prepared to fight this menace. And this is what allowed President Roosevelt to give J. Edgar Hoover the authority to really turn the FBI into a spy-chasing agency.
Was there any pushback, any feeling that J. Edgar Hoover might be consolidating too much power?
Absolutely. And after the war started in 1938,1939, when the war started in Europe, and there was what was called the phony war, where Hitler had taken Poland but made no move towards the West. Much publicity about J. Edgar Hoover receiving this authority, but when the war didn't continue, congressional critics became very loud in their denunciation of him and his power-grabbing ways. As soon as France fell and as soon as Hitler went into the West, those fears disappeared.
FBI stood behind Hoover.
Oh, absolutely. His position was precarious for a bit there, but he had some wily ways bureaucratically, that's for sure.
Didn't the FBI agent on that case quit?
Yes, a man named Leon Thoreau, who quit in order to go to Hollywood, basically.
To write the articles and the movie.
And J. Edgar Hoover was absolutely livid, and I think he fired him with prejudice and insisted that this would never happen again. He was really quite angry over this.
Although the FBI had its own wonderful pop culture machine. I remember the FBI in Peace and War on the radio.
Indeed, as long as J. Edgar Hoover was the center of those
stories. There were television series as well.
Right, and Melvin Purvis, who tried to push his own version of that FBI story, found himself frozen out as well. So Leon Thoreau is a version of Melvin Purvis.
Let's talk about William Sebald. When did he come to the United States?
He came. He served in World War I for the German. Born in Germany, served in the trenches of World War I, and during the instability of the Weimar years, he came to the United States initially in 1922. And he jumped ship, was an illegal immigrant, lived throughout the state of Texas, working various jobs for about a year. Then he went back to Germany and eventually did come back to the United States as a legal immigrant in 1929.
This is at the time when the Weimar Republic was going through all sorts of problems. There was a time when the U.S. dollar was worth 4.2 trillion marks.
Yes.
Is that why a lot of Germans decided to come to the United States, simply because they wanted more stable economic lives?
Absolutely. It was in the 1920s, I think, there were about 100,000 Germans who came to New York City itself. So there's a real community of these Weimar Germans living in New York. I think it's kind of a forgotten piece of history.
But then when Hitler came to power, many of them would have returned, wouldn't they?
Some of them returned because there was more prosperity. There was a war economy. Jobs were available in Hitler's Germany. Many of them did go back. Many did stay. They had lives here, and so they did stay.
And there were quite a few Nazi sympathizers right here in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and including a famous or infamous rally at Madison Square Garden.
Right. The German-American Bund was the largest of the Nazi fronts. This rally on February 20th, 1939, filled Madison Square Garden, really a Nuremberg rally, extremely anti-Semitic event, and quite shocking that it had existed in this city.
Didn't the German government discourage its citizens in America from joining the German-American Bund?
They did. It was really Hitler's idea was to keep America out of the war as long as possible, keep them neutral, and do not aid France and England. So they really wanted to avoid anything that would bring the Americans in. So that was the initial hope. That
Sebald was approached when he returned to Germany. Request for him to spy. What did they hope he could do?
Sebald, he went back in 1939 to visit his mother. I think this is indicative of his personality, that he thought he wouldn't be a problem. He had American citizenship at that point. When they learned that he had worked at an aircraft factory, and they were very keen on getting as much aircraft information as possible, that was the trigger to recruit him.
Is it fair to say that he had a fragile psyche?
You know, he was eventually later in life, he was diagnosed as a manic depressive, and
Would he be past muster today if people were looking for a spy?
Never. I can't imagine they would ever choose him as a spy. In fact, when the FBI's initial report on him was, we don't think this guy is worth much.
So he was hospitalized in Germany because he had kind of a breakdown.
Yes.
And then he went to the American embassy and said, I've been approached, been requested to do some spying. And you say that he wasn't taken seriously.
Yeah, first he wasn't taken seriously. He had to go back and demand a meeting with the consul general of the Cologne consulate. who finally, after the early days of the war had the hectic days of the war had subsided, they listened to him and then believed his story at that point.
So he told the Germans he would spy for them.
Yes, he did.
And what was his name? His code name for the Germans.
His given name was Wilhelm William Siebold, and they gave him the name to operate in New York as Harry Sawyer, and his code name was Tramp.
And what was he expected to do?
He was given training in Hamburg, given four names of spies in New York to make contact with. His job was to serve as a messenger and a contact man for Hamburg and to set up a radio station in order to communicate messages quickly between the two countries.
And he met Lang. How did Lang respond to him when they first met?
Siebold had to leave before Lang could kick him out. He wanted nothing to do with him. It took several meetings before he actually accepted that he was who he said he was.
And the Germans wanted to get Lang out of America because they were afraid that if a plane was found with the Norden, then people would have figured out that he's the one who passed all the information to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why was it so important for Siebold to get a confession from Lang and prove that he'd provided the Norden information to Germany?
Yeah, they really didn't have the evidence. At that point, the German technical office, the Luftwaffe's technical office, hadn't used the technology yet, and so any of the planes that had been examined, there wasn't evidence that they were using the same technology, so they needed him to get on the record on what he had done.
One of the oddest characters in this story is Lily Stein. She's a Jewish Austrian who worked for the Germans.
Yes.
Did she not know what was going on in Germany?
You know, she was a young woman from Vienna who needed a way to get out of Hitler-controlled Austria. And she used her body. She had an affair with the vice consul of the Vienna consulate, the American, a man named Ogden Hammond Jr. And she also, through her high society connections, she was someone very well connected in European high society, connected with the Germans, and they provided her, she was fully Jewish, but they provided her with a Nazi passport that identified her as a half-Jew and enabled her to get into the United States. And her mission was to seduce men of distinction and learn what she could about war secrets.
And did she know Siebold?
Yes, they had many meetings. She came on to him, and Siebold rebuffed her advances, and she said, "Why is it that you American men are always afraid of women?" She was quite a character. She never, I think her great achievement was making it into the United States.
At one point, you say someone suggests to Lily Stein that Siebold might be working for the British or the Americans. How did she respond?
And she didn't think he was doing that. She thought he was just out for her money, just out for the German money, to pretending that he was working for them so he could make off with the cash.
How did Siebold manage to get the FBI in continual radio contact with the Nazis?
So when he arrived in the United States, one of his missions on behalf of the Germans was to set up a radio connection with Germany, and the FBI did it. They set up out on Centerport, Long Island, set up a shortwave radio broadcasting station. A FBI special agent wound up sending the messages, a man named Maurice Price. And intercepted more than 300 messages from Germany.
Do you think that Siebold was so effective because he was underrated by both sides?
It's a very good point. The FBI at first, they thought he has an honesty complex. He's too...
Well, he said he never lied.
He never lies, and they thought, well, as soon as one of these spies says something that he doesn't like, he's going to fly off the handle and ruin the case. The Germans felt because of his World War I service, because of how German he was or seemed to them, that he wouldn't turn on them. And they also felt because of his physical weakness, he had a collapse, as you mentioned, in Germany, that he wasn't the type that we don't think he has the guts to turn against us.
Of course he did lie because you can't spy and not lie.
Exactly.
At what point did the FBI decide to make arrests?
This was a 16-month operation, very complex. It was the most complex FBI investigation.
The spy ring was called the Duquesne spy ring.
Spy ring was called called colloquially the Duquesne spy ring after Colonel Fritz Duquesne, who was a South African-born adventurer, was one of the four spies that Siebold was to meet when he came to the country. And eventually the war was turning. The U-boats were sinking American ships by the summer of 1941, and they decided they had to wrap it up.
But he discovered a number of spy rings, Siebold.
Yeah, of the 33 spies that were arrested, I count four separate spy rings with a smattering of lone wolves among them.
How many people were arrested of the accused? How many were naturalized American citizens?
It's a large majority. I don't have the number on the top of the head. I think it's 29, 28 were naturalized Germans. There were a few other. There were 34 warrants issued and 33 arrests. The one they didn't get was an Irishman named Sean Connolly.
Did the trial take place before we actually declared war, or Germany declared war on the United States after the bombing of Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, it was the fall of 1941. The trial occurred, and the guilty verdicts came down on December 12th, 1941, just a day after Hitler declared war on the United States.
Was Siebold an effective witness at the trials?
Yeah, they were very, again, worried about him in this regard, and he actually tried to get out of testifying before the case. He was worried about his reprisals against his family, but he wound up under pressure. He really came through, and there's some moments where the defense lawyers really went after him, and he held up quite well.
And then he disappeared before the verdict was read.
Yes, when they were done with him, he was relocated to San Francisco, outside of San Francisco, Walnut Creek, San Francisco.
Was there a feeling that his life was in danger?
Yes, they were very concerned. There was talk about changing his name legally, although he never did do that. In 1942, when Hitler sent U-boats to the United States, one of their missions was to find William Siebold. In later years, he became quite paranoid that they were still going to get him. And I think it contributed to the real mental instability in his later years.
And what kind of life did he live?
He had a sad ending to his life. He was a chicken farmer for a while. He worked at the post office in Walnut Creek, which he couldn't keep that job. So he never really kept a job for very long. And at the end of his life, he wound up being committed to a mental institution, a Napa State Hospital, for the last 5 years of his life, died in complete ignominy.
Yeah, which is very sad, since he is really one of the heroes of World War II.
Absolutely. I think a completely forgotten figure.
Peter Duffy's latest book, a follow-up to the Bielski brothers and the killing of Major Dennis Mahan, is Double Agent, the First Hero of World War II, and How the FBI Outwitted and Destroyed a Nazi Spy Ring. It is published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.